This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. This is episode 169. Gonna be 170 next week, as he said in a burst of obviousness. There's going to be a little more road noise here and there as we go home today, because I actually dropped in to pick up something for my wife at AutoZone, so I'm going to be taking another way home. If I can make a left out of the AutoZone parking lot, we will see. It's been a good week. We are working on a new project. Don't have final official approval on it yet, but it's being championed by enough people that I'm sure it's going to be fine. So I've been doing work on that all week, just pounding away, learning new stuff, and then getting up a proof of concept, and then working on a report. So I have been banging code all week. And my back's a little sore because of that. Because sometimes when I get banging code, I just sit there and code. I have to remind myself, stand up every hour. They say if you just stand up every hour for 2 minutes, just 2 minutes, that it's actually much, much better for you. Anyways, and I am working on writing now, actually writing the fourth book in the Grumpy Old Prophet series. I have started hearing back from some of the beta readers on the third book, and they've had some very kind things to say. The first one I heard back actually told me that the book had moved him on many levels, and that it was actually good for him to read it because he'd had a rough couple of years here, and this, it touched him and encouraged him. So it's like, hey, that's what we're looking for, you know? I write for dozens, I tell people. I don't write for millions or for thousands or for hundreds. I write for dozens. And if I can write something that will touch my beta readers, that's good enough. I think I mentioned this last week, but I had told a friend that as we were talking, that if I get this series finished and I don't write anything else, it will be enough, because I will have said enough. I very much had an idea of what was going to go into book four, which is called acting, but now that I've actually started writing it, it's so interesting how all of a sudden things start opening up. And started writing the first chapter in the book, and just all of a sudden it was more than I was expecting it to be. And it's like, hey, look at that. There we go. So I probably will be through the first chapter by the end of the weekend, and hopefully into the second chapter, possibly even finished with the second chapter, because these first couple of chapters should go pretty quickly. It's fairly simple. I know where things are and where things are going. Have a few little tweaks and details to work out in terms of motivations with the characters, mapping them to what the characters do in the Bible, but, you know, that's going to be fine. Anyways, this week, I mentioned last week that I might talk about the optimism bias, and then probably next week we're going to talk about the book You Are Not So Smart. That has a lot of chapters in it. I could spend a lot of time talking about each of those individual things, but I'll probably just brush the surface of some of the stuff that's a little more interesting out of there, and then who knows where we will go from there. But anyways, the optimism bias. I have started once again to try to get caught up on watching TED Talks. Lots of really interesting things in the TED Talks. I mean, it's just really fascinating. So I started using them to exercise with in the evenings, and it works out pretty good because they're usually either about 10 minutes or 20 minutes. So I can watch just one, or I can watch two of the 10-minuters, or four of the 5-minuters, minute-ers, and so that works out pretty well. This particular TED Talk is, I think, 18 minutes. It is by a woman whose name is Tali Shero, I'm assuming. It's actually S-H-R-O-T. Her first name is spelled T-A-L-I, in case you want to look it up and watch the talk. It is a TED Talk, and her TED Talk is called The Optimism Bias. And I'll just kind of go through the high points of what she was talking about and then sort of give you my reaction to some of these things. According to her, the optimism bias is a cognitive illusion that she's been studying, that it is our tendency as human beings to overestimate our likelihood of experiencing good events in our lives and underestimating our likelihood of experiencing bad events. She gave a bunch of different examples of this, but I'll just sort of hit some of the high points of them. The first example that she gave was of marriage. She said, when you look at the divorce rates in America, in Western civilization, the divorce rates are about 40%. But if you ask every couple who is getting married, what do you think is the likelihood that you will get a divorce? She said they estimate their likelihood at 0%. And she said, surprisingly enough, divorce lawyers, who in her estimation should know better, are just as bad at making these estimates as are people who are getting remarried. She had a cute quote. It was from Samuel Johnson, who said that remarriage is the triumph of hope over experience. Now, in my case, the fact of the matter is that I did get remarried, and I am still married to my second wife, and my estimation of my chance of ever getting a divorce again is zero. And we'll actually talk about why that is in a little bit. It's not because I don't realize that 40% of marriages end in divorce, but we'll get to that, back to that in a minute. She also had a lot of other things, about... For instance, she put up a picture of her nephew, and she said, of course, obviously people think that all of their children are uniquely talented, and I just want to point out here that in the case of my nephew, that's not true. He actually is uniquely talented. Of course, everybody laughed. It was very, really cute. And out of that, she said, the point is here that we're optimistic about ourselves and about our kids, not because we don't understand that bad things do happen to other people, but we believe that we're optimistic about our things that are going to happen to us because we have the unique ability to cause good things to happen to us, which is an important point that I want to come back to. She did also say that most of us statistically put ourselves in terms of abilities over others. And we've talked about that before, that something like 75% or 65% of Americans say that they are above average drivers. Well, okay, that is statistically impossible, but we say that. And we'll talk about why I think people say that in a moment. They have studied this across cultures, across the world, and in fact, it is a global phenomenon. All over the world, people have this optimism bias. And what they've been trying to figure out is it actually good for you to have an optimism bias? And she said some people will say no, that the secret to happiness is low expectations. However, in her research and in her opinions, that is not true. And she had three reasons that she gave why she did not believe that low expectations is the key to happiness. The first one was that in their research, they have found that whatever happens to you, whether you succeed or whether you fail, people with higher expectations always feel better. So she said, for instance, if you take a test and you get an A on it, if you have high expectations, if you're optimistic, if you evaluate yourself as being above average, you say, well, of course I got an A because I'm above average. Whereas if you take a test and you don't get an A, you say, well, okay, I didn't study for that test as hard as I could have, or the test wasn't written very well, but certainly I'm going to be doing better on the next test. Whereas she said, if you have a pessimistic viewpoint that you are under average and you're just not good on things, when you get an A on a test, you look at that and you say, oh, well, that was just a fluke. That's not going to happen again. And when you get a low grade on a test, you just say, well, yeah, that's because I'm stupid. And I really can't really expect to be able to get good grades on a test. And so you develop an expectation based on what your outlook is. She said the second reason that she believes that being optimistic is actually a better strategy in life is because the pure act of anticipation makes us happy. And one thing she brought out that was interesting was they did an experiment where they asked people, if you could make a wish and get a kiss from a celebrity, any celebrity that you wanted, when would you want to receive that kiss? Would you want to receive that kiss immediately? Or the next day? Or in 3 years? Or in a year? Or in 10 years? When would you want to receive this reward? And she said, most people don't want to receive it immediately. Neither do they want to wait for a year or 10 years. She said the optimum amount of time people seem to want to wait was about 3 days. And in her estimation, that gives people a chance to anticipate and to look forward to it and to enjoy that anticipation. She also brought up an interesting fact that when you ask people what's their favorite day of the week, of course, they're all going to say Saturday, because in America, we don't work on Saturdays. But then if you say, what's your next favorite day of the week, people will say Friday, even though they work on Friday. And that is followed by Sunday, even though they are off work on Sunday. And she attributed this to the fact that even though you're off work on Saturday, on Sunday you are anticipating going back to work. Whereas on Friday, even though you're at work, you're anticipating being off work. And so that anticipation trumps the actual activities that you're doing during the day in terms of how much you are enjoying the day, which I thought that was pretty interesting. Anyways, and the third reason that she gave that she feels like having high expectations are important in life is that their controlled experiments have shown that optimism is not only related to success, it leads to success. That if you believe you can do something, that you actually make the effort to do it, and that optimism itself contributes to your success. And I would absolutely agree with that. So the question she had, though, was, okay, so optimism is good for us, but how do we maintain it in the face of reality, in the face of all these statistics? And what she found was is that the brain has absolutely no problem maintaining this level of optimism in the face of reality. So, for instance, they brought in people and they said, okay, what do you think is your likelihood of getting cancer? She said people would answer. And then she said, you do understand that 30% of all people will get cancer. And after they absorbed that fact, then she said, so what percentage, what do you think is your chances of getting cancer? And she said, well, what's interesting is she said the people who were optimistic that they would not get cancer, even knowing that the cancer rate was about 30%, it really didn't change their feelings that much. If they said, oh, you know, 10%, maybe 10%, I'll get cancer. And then she said, well, you know, it's 30% is the national average. They said, okay, well, maybe it's 11% that I'll get cancer. At this point, everybody in the audience laughed. But I'm going to come back to this in a minute. Just a second. I'm getting my mail. And it looks like there might be a package for us. Oh, there is a package for me. That it is. That is my new vehicle mount for my phone, which is its own story. And a bill from Verizon, but that's okay. We love paying our bills from Verizon because we love 4G. It's fun to have. I'm happy to pay for things that I like. Anyways, so she said, whereas if you're talking to people about their cancer rates and they are pessimistic about life, understanding what the real rate is tends to cause a much greater change in their estimation. So if a person comes in and says, oh man, maybe 50%, I don't know, I'm backing into my garage. If then she tells them, well, it's actually 30% is the average, then they will say, well, okay, maybe it's only 35%. They're still a little pessimistic, but at least they're not as pessimistic as they were. So the optimism bias seems to carry a lot of weight. It seems to be able to buoy people up, even in the midst of information to the contrary. Now, they did do a little experiment where they put people in MRIs and then they figured out where the activity was in the brain when people were responding optimistically. And then they took this electromagnetic thing and slapped it on people's heads and were able to make the optimism bias disappear. Honestly, when I hear about all that stuff, I think, wow, I don't want people putting magnetic things against my brain. She claimed that, oh yeah, people go back to normal just shortly after. It's like, oh yeah, okay. Yeah, no thank you. I don't need magnetic pulses going through my skull. Thank you very much. But in my mind, at least, when she's talking about doing that, you're actually talking about a fairly crude exercise, because these magnetic pulses could be affecting a lot of other things. So while it's interesting, I didn't find it that interesting. She concluded her talk by relating the necessity for us to temper our optimism bias, because sometimes it does lead us to things where we overestimate our chances of survival and that becomes dangerous for them. She gave an example of firefighters, that sometimes they overestimate what stage the fire is at, or they overestimate how fatigued they are, and that does put them in danger. And she had an illustration that I thought was a fun little illustration. There was a cliff and there were a bunch of penguins. And some penguins were just hopping off and going headfirst down the cliff and, of course, would splat at the bottom. And other penguins were at the top looking and not wanting to jump. And she was saying the ones at the top were like the ones with a pessimistic outlook. They would never actually try and attempt anything because they were afraid. the ones that were just jumping off were the ones that were thinking, oh, well, hey, let's just try this, you know, taking the leap. But she had another little penguin on there, and the little penguin was actually using the parachute. And her idea was that we should enjoy our optimism and use our optimism to give us strength to move forward. But we should also recognize that we may be overestimating and we need a backup plan as well, a parachute, if you will. And she said in those cases, she kind of sees that as the best of both worlds, as I do too. Anyways, so that was kind of what she was talking about. As I was listening to this, there were a few things, and I'm just going to kind of run back through her notes because that will remind me of the things that I was thinking about. First of all, when we talk about divorce rates in the United States and people say, well, the divorce rate is 40%, what do you think the chances are that you're going to get a divorce? And people say 0%. Okay, some of that may be the optimism bias in some people. I'm not sure I would have said 0%, because obviously there's all kinds of things that can happen in life, and you're dealing with two people in life. But I would say that the chance of divorce is 0% between two people, no matter who they are, who get married and follow a path of listening to their spirits and not their flesh. It is 0%. That is the truth. Because there's no reason that two people cannot remain committed to each other if they follow the spirit and not the flesh. The fact of the matter is, overseas there are arranged marriages, and a far greater percentage of those arranged marriages succeed than do our marriages in Western cultures where we get to choose our mate. Why is that? Because people are committed to those marriages and they accept that they should be in those marriages, and their parents understand that this person would be a good match for them, and they're committed and they just stay in them. There's no reason that a marriage has to fail. Marriages fail because one or both parties begin to exhibit characteristics of the flesh. So when I say the chances of my marriage failing and getting divorced, my current marriage failing and me getting a divorce, is close to zero, that's not really optimism bias. That's just the truth. And my wife and I this year will be celebrating our 24th wedding anniversary. And there's really no signs on the horizon that we won't be celebrating our 25th and our 30th and our 40th and our 50th and our 60th, aside from the fact that one or both of us are going to die at some point. So I don't really consider that optimism bias. In addition, when we start talking about things like asking people, do you believe you're above average driver? I think there is some confusion there because the human brain is not really very good at running statistics. And I think what the human brain is doing there is converting the phrase above average driver to are you a good driver? At whatever good is defined as. Now, you know, occasionally I get speeding tickets. Does that mean that I believe I am not a good driver? No, because I have not had a wreck that I have caused. Let me think. Ever? Maybe? At the very least, for years and years and years and years. And the way I would define being a good driver is one who does not get into wrecks. I'm sure people have all kinds of different definitions of what it means to be a good driver. And I think that's what they're really reflecting on. And more importantly, what they're reflecting on is, do I have the capacity to be a good driver? And the fact is that, yes, I do. And more on that in a moment. I absolutely agree with her that you can live a stronger and more successful life if you are optimistic. I absolutely do agree with that. In addition, I'm not sure it's, depending on who you're talking to, it's optimism bias if, for instance, you would ask me, what are my chances of contracting cancer? Because I would put it at lower than 30%. And you could tell me, well, the average rate is 30%. And I would say, well, yeah. But 68% of Americans are also overweight, and 28-ish percent of Americans are also obese. And the fact of the matter is that if you are obese, the chance of you contracting cancer is much higher. I know this not only from reading reports, I know this because of insurance rates. And the particular insurance that I'm on, I know of people who cannot get that insurance. And the reason they cannot get that insurance is because the insurance company looks at them and looks at their statistics and says, yeah, we're not going to insure you. Because we know statistically you have a much higher incident of fatal diseases like cancer, heart attack, stroke, of fatal events. And we don't want to pay for those things, so we're not going to insure you. So I have an insurance company who does not suffer, that does not suffer from an optimism bias, that is in fact telling me that I will come in lower than the average rate of affliction when it comes to cancer. And they are betting on it. And they have actuaries who study all this stuff. So I don't think it's necessarily optimism bias when someone tells me the average is 30%. What do you think you are? And I say, 10, 15, maybe. In addition to all of that, though, there is this thing that she brushed up against a couple of times. And that is this idea of knowledge, of tempering our optimism bias with knowledge, and this interaction of quote-unquote reality and optimism bias and how it all fit together. And here's how I would say it all fits together within the framework of spirit and flesh. I think within us, in the spirit, there is an optimistic voice that is speaking to us all day long, that is encouraging us in the way of kindness and love and gentleness and mercy, that is indicating to us that through those things we create an environment of success, and as we continually move there and we get whispers from God, we end up being in the right place at the right time, and that leads to a very optimistic viewpoint on life. I do not think that's fake. I think that exists well grounded in reality. Does that mean that we will never have troubles? No, absolutely not. Of course we'll have troubles. Troubles actually help strengthen us. I was talking to a friend this week. He and his wife have been through some hard things in the last few weeks, but coming out the back of it now, they're actually stronger than they were going in. And when he was in the midst of it, I was encouraging him, as others were, as they were encouraging themselves, hold on, trust, believe, everything's going to be okay. Is that optimism bias? It's been my experience, that is not optimism bias. Fact is, over and over and over again, I have seen God do really interesting and amazing things to bring about a good outcome. So on the spirit side, we are naturally inclined to be optimistic. What the flesh will do, unfortunately, is take that optimism and will say, oh, well, that means you can just run off and do this. Oh, well, that means you can run off and do that. Oh, well, that means you can, you know, for instance, when I was working on the vein work stand, there was this voice in me that kept saying, oh, yeah, you're going to sell a lot of these. Oh, you don't have to worry about those people that keep telling you that they want it to fold up. You don't have to worry about that. You can just make it to the desk stand. You're not going to have any problem marketing this thing because I know other people have it. You know, you're going to be great. Okay, well, as I've gotten on the backside of the vein work stand, I've realized that, yes, in fact, a lot of that optimism that I had about that building that product was in fact generated by my flesh. And I think one of the easy ways to kind of try to figure out whether the optimism is generated by spirit or by flesh is, are there going to be monetary rewards involved? And are you getting so interested in the monetary rewards and what you can do when you get rich, woo, yeah, that you're really blind to the fact that this is an uphill battle and there is a certain quantity of chance in all of this, and it's going to be hard work. Frankly, there were plenty of things that I could have done. And there were plenty of pieces of information that I did not have, that I did not know I did not have, and research that I did not do. And so I can look back in my experience with the vein work stand and with my preparation for the vein work stand, and I can nod my head and say, yeah, I was falsely optimistic about a lot of those things. And I can assure you that the next time I go into those types of things, I will be much more careful about my research. So, was optimism bias at work in me in those things? Yes. Yes, it was in the vein work stand. No question. Are all my optimistic outlooks in life the result of an optimistic bias? No. Because some of my optimism comes directly from the spirit, and some of my optimism comes from the fact that I have embraced certain disciplines in my life that external sources actually speak to me and say, yeah, your chances of contracting this or this happening to you are lower than average, or you are above average in certain skill sets, like being able to relate to people and work well with others. Because I, as a consultant, those are crucial skills, and the reason I get paid what I get paid is because I play well with others. And that's a direct result of me living along spiritual paths as opposed to living along fleshly paths. So the sum of all this is there is optimism in the spirit, and it's good. There is optimism in the flesh that can lead you down the wrong path and cause you to fail spectacularly. But what was called optimism bias as a blanket for all these things, I think, is a bit of a misnomer, because some of our optimism can really be true. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.